A South African Airways 747-200 Combi is taking off after a stopover when they crash into the ocean. What caused this flight to have a tragic water landing?
Welcome back to the Hard Landings Podcast, everybody. I'm Nick.
I'm Miranda.
And I'm Christy.
Hey, hey, hey.
Hey, 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 hey.
Hello.
Do we have any new patrons?
Because
I don't know.
Feel like I saw one, but I could be wrong. It all blends together now.
It does all blend together.
Time blends together right now.
Time does.
Patreon says potentially. Please hold.
By the time we record the next episode, so last time we recorded that one, and by the time that one comes out, we will be married. But we still aren't married yet as of the recording of this one. But by the time we record the next one, we will be married.
This is the last it's a technical thing. Term.
Yes. This is the last thing we're recording before we get married.
I don't think we have any new paid members.
Okay.
Okay.
But thank you to all of the free members.
Yes.
You guys are all trickling in like mad. So.
Thanks.
We appreciate it.
Which is not trickling. I don't know.
You know what you mean. We know what you mean.
Yes. Maybe. Pouring in. Flooding in.
Okay, so go do the normal stuff. I should have already sent out the newsletter by now, and if I didn't, someone yell at me, and I'll do it. It's
yelling,
done.
Yelling,
potentially.
Yelling.
And then I walked in today, and Christy and Nick were like, we are going to change things. And I was like, well.
We might not. We might not.
So, anyway. If stuff is wrong, please don't say anything. It changes all the time.
Things do change.
Things happen. We have to change stuff. It happens. So.
I don't know. We've discussed a little bit, and I don't know if we're going to change anything. We'll see.
Make sure to check out all the stuff. Patreon, merch page. It's been a while since anyone bought merch. Just saying.
Just saying.
Not that I'm
It actually has been. It's bitter. Been months.
It's been a long time.
It's weird.
Which, you know what? You don't got to buy merch.
No, but it's expensive, and I get it.
But you should.
But you should.
Is there any new stuff? I want merch.
If there's anything, think about it. If you're not a patron, which gets you all sorts of stuff. That is a whole different way that you can contribute and get something directly.
Yes. A whole new world.
That both supports us and gives you something to wear,
gives
use.
You I don't cool. Know.
Something like that.
Sure, we'll go cool. Okay.
Beauty? Coffee? What?
What? I don't know. Christy's looking stuff up. Anyway.
We can brand our own skincare?
Let's not do that.
Get your hard landing skincare.
No.
Only because some of that stuff
make a lot
is
of sense.
Pretty fleeting.
Yeah.
Which we had issues with, and I really don't want to have to go back and redo a
I know,
whole bunch
I just
of stuff.
I thought it was funny.
I'm still so sad about the pajamas.
Dude, the pajamas were so limited.
I know.
They were limited time only, and apparently. We didn't even get any.
Okay, but can we talk about the coffee, though?
No.
The brand is owned by Printify. It's called Roastify.
That's weird. But okay. Weird flex, but okay.
Yeah, weird flex, but okay.
If you want your Hard Landings coffee, please comment and tell us if that's actually something you want.
I don't think anybody wants that.
There's duffel bags now. And weekender bags. And laundry bags.
Cool.
I want a laundry bag.
We have laundry bags. Anyway.
Okay, I think that's it for housekeeping. I was going to say homecoming. Housekeeping. So what are we covering today, Nick?
Today. We are covering South African Airways Flight 295.
Thank you to a lot of people for recommending this.
This one was recommended.
There was a lot.
Yeah, this one, I know there's at least three names on the list, but I...
There's four.
There's four now?
Oh.
No, there's three.
No, that was for
there's
a different
three.
One.
Okay, there's three on this list.
Thank you to Jacob, Tasha, and Danielle, and whoever else we missed. There's probably more in our inbox.
This one is a relatively large one with a lot of... layers. It's an onion.
It's an ogre.
It's an ogre. It's an onion.
If you don't get that reference, school yourself.
You were born after 2001.
No, even people who were born after 2001 know that reference.
Yeah.
Not all of them. Okay.
Okay. So this accident occurred on November 27th of 1987.
That's important, actually.
It actually is for a lot
November
of reasons.
November 7th, 1987.
It's more of a year.
November 27th.
27th, 1987.
Yes, the year does matter. 1987 is more important than anything because there's a lot of things that come with being in 1987. On top of it being...
things that we didn't know yet that we learned years later and therefore were not in the report.
On top of it also just being one of the, you know, the deadliest years of aviation.
The 80s were not a good time.
No! No.
Not a good time.
70s were...
If you're gonna time travel and go fly on a plane, don't do it in the 80s.
Yeah.
Or the 70s. And probably not the 60s either.
Yeah. This is a Boeing 747-244B combi.
Which is also important.
We'll talk combi, about this. Huh? This gets to be an interesting topic, something we've never talked about before.
Combi is short for combination.
Because, okay, so most airliners are capable of carrying cargo, whether it be large pallet or small boxes, in the cargo hold underneath the passengers, right? Well, combis take that a step further, and they actually block off part of the passenger cabin, or the main deck, it's called. And that becomes a cargo area. They put in a big cargo door usually to load from the side. And then the rest of it remains a passenger cabin. So it's like a reduced passenger count wide-body aircraft with a higher cargo capacity. So this being a combi, it's very specific and it's very important. Combis are still actually, I wouldn't call them common, but they're definitely around today. They tend to be older aircraft. And a few carriers have been very pertinent in using them throughout the years, KLM being one of them. They did it with the 747-400, we'll talk about more later on. And the South African Airways had the 747-200, but like Alaska uses them. They had them on the 747 or the 737-400 for a long time. Then they had some variations of the 737-700 that were combi. And then in Canada, there's actually quite a few as well. 737-200s that are combis. But there's a bunch out there flying around the world. Weird combi-type aircraft. And it really is a strange thing. So this being a combi, obviously, that's a pertinent detail. We'll talk about it. But in this case, the 747-200 that they're flying, the forward part of the main deck, and then, of course, the upper deck has passenger seats.
Mm-hmm.
The rear quarter of the main deck is cargo.
Okay.
So at the very rear part of what would be the passenger cabin is a cargo compartment.
I also call it a cargo cabin to differentiate it from the cargo
compartments
underneath.
Right. Yeah. They call it the main deck cargo compartment.
If I say cargo cabin, just know that that's what I mean.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This one had the tail number Zulu Sierra-Sierra Alpha Sierra, and it also was named the Helderberg.
This is called the Helderberg disaster.
It is called the Helderberg disaster.
Which means this doesn't go well.
Not at all.
I mean, it's also on this podcast.
Okay, but there are some things on this podcast that go, like, okay. Like, it could have gone better, but it wasn't, like, a disaster.
This is a disaster.
Me too. Same.
This is a flight from Taipei's Chiang Kai-shek airport to Mauritius, the Plaisance airport in Mauritius, to Johannesburg in South Africa, be it that, you know, South African Airways. We'll talk about the whole South Africa thing later.
Okay.
But it's South Africa in the 80s. So.
For those of you not up to date on your history, that's during the apartheid.
Yes.
And.
Pertinent, actually.
Those of a lighter skin tone were. How far on a scale do I want to go with this next statement?
More fortunate in the country.
And because of that, the world basically said, you suck.
Yeah.
We're not going to do business with you.
Right. All of that will matter later.
It kind of matters now.
Kind of, but we'll talk about that later.
Well, so to put in perspective, the reason that they have to fly the way that they are from Taipei.
Yes.
Is because they're not allowed to fly over certain countries because certain countries are like, hey, screw you. You suck. Maybe don't do that to your population. You're not allowed to fly over my country.
Right. So they make a stop in Mauritius.
Are we one of those countries?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I am not up to date on the 80s history
of South Africa.
South Africa.
Which so. I get.
It's racist. It was bad.
Well, I figured it was racist.
That's
most places were very racist.
But that's what an apartheid is. They took it to an extreme. This was like blatantly outright racism.
Yeah. So they had to take very long routes around the world and make fuel stops in places because they couldn't fly over certain countries. It made it very difficult to traverse the world. So.
Cool. So. The crew. The captain was Dawid Jacobus Uys. I'm trying here, all right? He was 49 years old. He had 13,834 hours total, of which 3,884 were on the 747, which actually made him, believe it or not, the second lowest time pilot on the 747 in the cockpit.
Hmm.
Out of five.
This is the captain?
The captain.
Okay.
He has the highest time overall, but he is the second lowest time on the 747. The first officer, was David Atwell. He was 36 years old. At the time, he had 7,362 hours total, of which 4,096 were on the 747. The second first officer was Jeffrey Burchall, who was 37 years old and had 8,749 hours total, of which 4,555 hours were on the 747. The first flight engineer was Giuseppe, or Joe, Bellegarda, who was 45 years old and had 7,804 hours total, of which 4,254 hours were on the 747. And then the second flight engineer was Alan Daniel, who was 34 years old and had 1,595 hours total, of which 227 were on the 747. So the second first officer and the second flight engineer are the relief crew for this relatively long flight.
Relatively long, meaning?
A little over 10 hours.
Oh, yeah.
From Taipei to Mauritius.
I would say that would be relatively long.
Yeah. Yes.
From Taipei again, to Mauritius. Like, it's that way because South Africa was sanctioned and could not fly over certain countries, so they had to fly over mostly water.
Yep, exactly. In Taipei, 140 passengers and 19 crew boarded the flight, along with 6 pallets of cargo on the main deck. So that being that cargo compartment at the rear of the main deck.
How many passengers? Sorry.
140.
Okay.
Not a lot for a 747.
Well, if half of the cabin is a...
Right. It's a reduced cabin.
Cargo cabin, then yeah, that would make sense.
It's a reduced cabin, but I still feel like 140 still feels small.
Yeah, probably.
That number's reduced for sure. It's definitely not full, I would say. This flight is not full.
Mind you, there's also still an upper deck.
Yeah, it's very small, though. On the 747-200, it's very small. You might be able to put like 4 rows of seats up there.
Well, those people may have been a little more fortunate.
Maybe.
That's not foreshadowing.
Usually on the 747, and this is something I think I've talked about in the past, but it's cool. They actually generally put first or business class in the nose rather than upstairs.
There
usually is a business class upstairs, and it's cool to sit on the top deck and all. But actually, I think it's cooler to sit in the nose of a 747 because if you're in the very first row...
There are windows at the front?
The windows, because of the way the cabin curves at the front, your window practically looks forward.
That's cool.
Which is crazy to me. It doesn't quite look all the way forward, but you see more forward than you would with any other window on an airplane, basically,
right.
On a passenger window on an airliner, which is pretty cool. The aircraft had arrived at Taipei late, and weather also caused further delays in departing Taipei. That flight was scheduled originally to depart at 9 p.m. local time, but the flight actually departed Taipei at 10:23 p.m. local time, so an hour 23 minutes late. The estimated flight time was 10 hours and 14 minutes to Mauritius. Obviously, we're talking about the leg from Taipei to Mauritius. We're not talking about the second part of that.
Clearly, the second part of that did not happen.
No, it did not.
Okay.
Nope. Which was another like 5-6 hours, something like that, beyond Mauritius to Johannesburg.
Yeah.
Doesn't really matter because we're not talking about it. The takeoff, climb, and most of the cruise proceeded normally.
Okay.
The flight made routine position reports to flight information centers, or FICs, at Hong Kong, Bangkok, Kuala Lumpur, Colombo, Cocoa Islands, and eventually Mauritius along the way. So making position reports just to everybody.
Hey, we're here.
We're here. We estimate being here at here time. About 1 hour 27 minutes into the flight, a routine report was made to the operator's base at Jan Smuts, which is a location.
Okay.
In South Africa, by the flight crew, reporting their takeoff time, their cruise altitude of flight level 310 or 31,000 feet, and an estimated arrival time at Mauritius of 35 minutes after midnight UTC, which is actually 4:35 a.m. local time in Mauritius. Early. So this is an all-night flight. Left in the dark, flies in the dark, lands in the dark. Whole thing's just in the dark. The company radio operator then requested that the next call be by the crew at 6 p.m. UTC, which is only 2 hours ahead of where they're calling now.
Mm-hmm.
There were, however, no further communications between the flight and the company base radio operator during the flight. But that is to say, not entirely required or abnormal, although I think the company required it. This was not necessarily unique to South African Airways, this procedure, because all the airlines at the time were calling into company radios.
Mm-hmm.
This is calling into the base, and they actually had a very specific set of procedures, and they had some unique equipment that allowed them to call in a different way. Let me put it that way. And it would give them warnings in the cockpit, visual and auditory warnings in the cockpit of when to call in. However, all that beside the point, they never did again. It gets brought up in the report, but it's not really pertinent. The flight did continue to make radio calls to the FICs, though, so the position reports, which are just, those aren't company operated necessarily, they're flight information centers, so they are general use for all commercial aviation around the world. These flight information centers still exist, however, they're in a different capacity than they really were back then. Flight information centers being called in for position reports is a little bit different now. We wouldn't do that. Flight information centers truly give you more. They're there for information about your en route weather, about, you know, pilot reports, NOTAMs, anything like that. Airspace questions, things like that. So they're useful still, but at the time they were being used primarily to also report position. Regular call-ins. 2:30 a.m. local time in Mauritius. The flight called the Mauritius FIC and reported being 070 degrees, that being longitude, right?
Dude, I don't know.
Now I gotta think.
What comes first, latitude or longitude?
It's only, well, they only gave the degrees.
Oh.
It's the, but it's your verticals.
Longitude, I think.
Yes, latitude is a lateral.
Yeah, lateral.
Longitude is
yes.
The long way, yes, vertical.
Vertical. I used to be really good at this.
Longitude is vertical.
Okay. 070 degrees longitude. So that is where they are at the 070 degrees east of quote unquote center being where UTC time also is. It's Greenwich
Mean Time.
Mean Time. Same place. So 70 degrees off of that. They're out over the Indian Ocean. At flight level 350, 35,000 feet. And estimating time to 065 degrees east, so 5 degrees further west than they are now, was 3:12 a.m. local time, which is 42 minutes later. They're going by these longitudinal degrees because they're not near anything right now. They're in one of the most remote places on the planet, by the way. Some of those are in the Indian Ocean. There is nothing out there.
Yeah.
There's water.
A lot of it. A lot of it. So they're using these degrees instead because they're not. There's nothing to report being over other than water.
Right.
So they're using degrees. So they reported that their next degree mark, their next position report, would be at 312. Well, at 3:13 a.m. and 27 seconds, the flight called in and reported being at 65 degrees east at flight level 350 and was now estimating being at 060 degrees east at 3:58 a.m. local time. Sometime about 28 minutes after this call, however, the flight crew, all of the main crew who are now back in the cockpit preparing to approach Mauritius, because they are close, they're within an hour, theoretically, of reaching Mauritius, received a fire warning in the cockpit.
That's not good.
No. Everything happened very fast after that, although I do have quite a bit more to talk about, but the captain inquired about where the warning came from, and the flight engineer notified him that it was coming from the main deck cargo area.
Okay.
So that combi compartment, the cargo compartment on the main deck.
Mm-hmm.
The captain then requested that a fire checklist be read, a very specific one. 3:48 a.m. and 51 seconds, the flight contacted Mauritius Approach Control on 119.1. About 16 seconds after this initial contact, the captain reported to the air traffic controller that they had a, quote, smoke problem end quote. And we're doing an emergency descent to 14,000 feet. Breathable air altitude, basically. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about this in a minute, but that is for a reason, and it is quite interesting.
Never heard of that one before.
No, this is wild. The captain then asked that fire services be alerted at the airport, so be prepared. The controller then asked if they were requesting full emergency services, and the captain responded that they were.
Just in case!
They're like, we've got smoke, and we're descending quickly, and when we get there, we want everyone. 3:51 a.m. in 2 seconds, the air traffic controller asked the flight for their actual position. The captain responded, but not with their position. The captain responded by saying, quote, now we have lost a lot of electrics. We haven't got anything in the aircraft now, end quote. Hmm. So their electrics are failing quickly.
That, my thought goes to burning wires and things that shouldn't be burned.
Good thought.
It's definitely a good thought. Yep.
You might also notice.
Ergo via Swissair.
Yeah, it's very...
That's not the first time that that got mentioned on the Air Disasters episode.
No.
There is an Air Disasters episode, by the way.
Mayday.
It's old.
It's one of the old ones.
There was something intelligent I was going to say. Oh, you may notice that the conversation within the cockpit doesn't exist anymore.
No.
That's because probably the wires to the CVR got cut, yeah?
Also a good thought!
How'd you guess?
Aw, just lucky.
Yeah. 3:52 a.m. in 33 seconds, the air traffic controller asked the flight for their ETA to the airport, their estimated time of arrival, to the airport, and the flight crew told them 4:30 a.m. local time. That was a very rough thing. This was a very short communication. 3:52 a.m. and 50 seconds, which is only 27 seconds later, the captain made an inadvertent radio call while talking to the flight engineer, stating over the radio, quote, hey, Joe, shut down the oxygen left, end quote, which is strange.
My thought process goes to not feeding the fire oxygen.
That's a good thought.
You're having a lot of those today.
A lot of those.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. 4:01 a.m. and 34 seconds. So now we're about 8 minutes later, a little over 8 minutes later. The captain inadvertently made another radio call, lasting about 40 seconds, during which he was giving instructions to the flight engineer with an excited or exclamatory tone.
I would say probably exclamatory.
Yes.
Probably not excited.
They listed it in the report always as excited, and I was like, I have a feeling what you mean here.
That word does not mean what you think it means.
Right. I mean, in a dictionary sense, excited is correct. There's exclamation points after everything he would say, I'm sure. However, they couldn't make out most of what he was saying. We'll talk about that later on. But he was saying something to the flight engineer. That just happened to be over the radio?
Also, a lot of what's happening over the radio and within the cockpit is in Afrikaans.
Yeah.
Not English.
Right. That's part of why it was a little difficult to determine what he said. 4:02 a.m. and 43 seconds, the captain made a distance report to the air traffic controller of 65 nautical miles. Great. The air traffic controller believed this to be the distance to the airport. However, that was not the case. This was actually the distance to the next waypoint, which was X-ray Alpha Golf Alpha Lima. The aircraft's actual distance to the airport was still 145 nautical miles, more than twice the distance.
Amazing.
But they didn't know that. The air traffic control. Because they just said, we're 65 nautical miles out.
Okay.
No clarification on that. Following this report, the air traffic controller re-cleared the flight down to 5,000 feet, so descend even lower. Sometime, while the flight was at a low altitude, the flight crew informed the air traffic controller, can I say it? Can I say this? What they did?
Do it, because I don't talk about it.
Okay. The flight crew informed the air traffic controller that they had opened some doors to allow smoke to escape.
What?
That is actually a legal procedure.
What?
And actually, it was perhaps the safer thing to do.
It solved a problem.
Part of the descent down to breathable altitude was so that they could depressurize the airplane to open the doors to let the smoke out.
I still don't feel very comfy about that.
No.
It's not a problem, actually.
No.
But if you say it's okay, I'll trust you that it's okay.
They had to slow down quite a bit in order to do so. You have to be below a certain speed as well to allow the doors to open.
Well, yeah, because if you go too fast, the doors are just going to be
There's too
shut.
Much pressure.
You can't open.
There's too much pressure. It's also, still fast, though. They were moving still like 250 knots.
Also, there are some passengers at this point who could not give it.
Well, we'll talk about that later. So yeah, that's happening.
It's a choice.
It is a choice.
It was a good choice. It did not save them.
Yeah. 4:03 a.m., the air traffic controller gave weather information for the airport to the crew, which was acknowledged by the captain. 4:03 a.m. and 43 seconds, the air traffic controller requested which runway they intended to use for landing, and the captain replied runway 13, but was then corrected by the air traffic controller to be runway 14, as there was no runway 13 at the airport. They've got other problems, okay? Yeah, they do have other problems. This actually makes sense, though, because if they had done this route before, the airport had recently done a runway change, runway number change, from runway 13 to runway 14.
Okay, that makes more sense.
And they did this because of magnetic variation.
Yeah, we've talked about that before.
Yes. So over time,
poles change.
The poles change, things shift.
The Earth said, I don't like your numbers, so right. I'm going to make my own numbers.
Every airport goes through an audit and therefore a runway number change every once in a blue moon. It really is not often. Rocky Mountain Metropolitan Airport, or JEFCO.
Oh, JEFCO. I was like,
Broomfield JEFCO.
Yes. Redid their numbers about 10 years ago. So all their runway numbers changed for magnetic variation. But every airport goes through it. It happens about every 20 years. It really depends on the airport. Every airport's different. They go to them and they point a compass down the
runway.
The runway, and they say, that's
doesn't. You are incorrect.
That doesn't match anymore.
Yeah.
And then I'm sorry.
And they change it.
And then they have to change it, yeah.
Yep. And it changes all the charts and everything.
Of course it does.
Yep.
Look at Mother Nature giving us the big middle finger.
Yeah. I don't give a flying
Yeah.
You want to go that way? Oh, well.
Oh, well. I'm going to change it on you. Very slowly. Very slowly. So I'm going to change it.
Slowly puts the middle finger.
Mother Nature's got all the time in the world.
Yes. Yep. I like what you said about, yeah, they've got other stuff going on, because that becomes extremely clear in the next little exchange, which also happens to be the last exchange. Mm. 4:03 a.m. and 56 seconds, the air traffic controller cleared the flight to fly direct to the approach beacon and requested that the flight report being at 5,000 feet. 4:04 a.m. and 2 seconds, the captain replied to this with, K. And that was it.
You know,
this would.
I feel like when you're on fire and clearly there's like stuff going on, you're like, you know what?
Yeah. The problem that I have here is that they still never really officially declared an emergency.
Nope.
What is that? Was the same way with the past several accidents we've covered.
Agreed. In the Mayday episode, they're like, or was it the Mayday episode or was it the report? It was something.
I don't know.
One of my sources. I was like, yeah, pilots are reluctant to call Mayday. Like, should you be, though? I would prefer to call Mayday and not actually mean it later on, rather than put it off and turn out you actually mean it.
For safety reasons, yes. They didn't even declare a pan-pan, though, as in panic, which is still saying we have a major issue. It's not at the level of needing to immediately be on the ground. However, this is definitely an emergency. 100%. We'll talk about that later on. But his short reply definitely should have been an indication. This was also the last time that they would be heard from. For the next 4 minutes, the air traffic controller did not try to contact the flight. For any reason, they didn't have anything to talk about. Turns out that was a very important 4 minutes. The flight also did not reach out to air traffic control. We'll talk about that later on. But then at 4:08 a.m., the air traffic controller did try to reach out to the flight and received nothing.
Nothing.
Are you alive? No.
No.
I'm sure they were trying to give them some kind of instruction, and there was nothing. Jeff. They had reported that they were going to be at the airport by 4:30.
And it was 4:30, huh?
So the air traffic controller kept trying between 4:08 a.m. and 4:30 a.m., thinking, maybe they'll just show up.
Show up? Yeah.
Well, they didn't. So at 4:30, when they didn't, you know, by this point, the air traffic controller is like, okay, there should be an airplane here. That's when they were expecting them. There should be an airplane here, and there isn't.
Right.
A big one. They couldn't see anything. They couldn't hear anything. There was no sign of an airplane.
And they would not be seen again for another year.
Unfortunately, that's true. Over a year, actually.
I thought it was a year to the day.
They said that, but in the report, it's a year to the day from the moment that they found the first bit of debris.
Oh.
Which is a month and a half after the actual accident.
Oh. Okay.
Which is strange to me, so I don't know.
Hmm.
Okay.
Mayday coming in clutch with questionable facts.
Yeah, I don't know. All of this to say, I don't know for sure, but obviously I've jumped a little bit ahead there.
I jumped ahead.
Yes. So search and rescue operations were initiated by air traffic control immediately after 4:30 because there was no airplane. The aircraft had crashed in the dark hours of the morning into the Indian Ocean around 4:07 a.m. local time.
This was determined to...
Am I okay to talk about that?
Okay.
I have it written down.
Okay, then go for it, because I don't...
Okay, we'll get there in just a moment. Fun little tidbit they liked to throw in the story, and I was like, sure, I'll put this in there.
Sure.
Two witnesses on the southeastern shore of Flat Island, about 6 nautical miles to the north of Mauritius, stated having seen a red and yellow colored object descending rapidly from the sky and then disappearing behind Round Island at about the time of the accident. But there
were... Did they happen to mention the red and orange was glowing?
Yes, but they determined that none of that mattered or was pertinent, and what they had actually probably seen was a meteorite.
Oh!
That's pretty good. I mean, you weren't helpful, but that was pretty cool.
The direction they were facing, the location where they had seen this, plus the speed of said falling object...
Was incorrect.
As well as they determined, eventually based on other factors, which we'll talk about, that this fire would not have been visible from the ground, as it could not be seen outside of the aircraft. So there was no way that this was correct. It was probably a meteorite.
Okay.
You tried.
The search had commenced on November...
How did they determine it was a meteorite?
I think they were like, I don't know what else you saw. Something falling from the sky in flames. Probably a meteor. That's it. That's all.
Sure.
Fell into the ocean. Don't know. The search had commenced on November 30th, but was eventually abandoned after a little to nothing was found. Over the next 2 months, floating debris was found, but little of use. However, they did find 3 wristwatches, which helped them determine the time of the accident. And they did this because 2 of them were still on Taipei time.
Mm-hmm.
However, 1 of them had the minute marked because of the impact.
Yeah.
It had stopped and the minute was still marked. And that helped them determine the minute that the accident had happened. They knew the hour already, of course, because of air traffic control communications, but they didn't know the exact time, so they figured out the minute. 4:07.
Do you talk about the other things that floated?
The bodies?
Yeah, that.
No.
Oh.
That did happen, though.
They found parts of 8 bodies?
Right. Sorry for that. But they did, and this actually became really useful. This is the only other really useful thing that they found. Otherwise, everything else was very small debris, floating debris, that ultimately... was inconsequential to the investigation.
And they know that they were able to identify 5 of the bodies.
Yes.
How? I don't know. That was not specified.
They did not explain. Some things in the report were not explained well, or the episode.
Okay.
Does not matter. That's how things went. So, through December, the search for the black box is using a locator searching for the pings from the locator beacons.
Yeah.
By a U.S. salvage company.
Was done for the 30-day activation period of the beacons.
The beacon, yeah.
They actually arrived with 7 days left.
Yes. They didn't have a lot of time.
Because, you know, you have to get a boat all the way from the U.S. to the Indian Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
To the specific area in the Indian Ocean, too, which is not near anything. So this is a challenge. So this took time, and they ultimately didn't find anything. They couldn't hear any pings, nothing. Couldn't find anything. Eventually, in January, all search efforts were halted for the remainder of the wreckage. It had been... So by that point, it became too expensive, basically, for them to continue. They already spent a lot of money. However, of course, it had been determined that at this point, everybody perished in the accident. So all 159 on board perished. And the debris that they had found was very small, which meant it was a heavy impact. That said, investigators were determined to get answers. They even said in the episode, they were like, it would have been easy for us to say we couldn't get anything. We couldn't salvage the airplane. So this one is, we don't know. But instead...
Nevertheless, they persisted.
A specialized piece of sonar equipment was used to scour the ground. You know, the seabed. The seabed, if you will. And they had actually found something. And they brought it to the lead investigator and went, there's your airplane.
And he's like, excuse me, how do you know this isn't like a World War II sub?
And they said to him, I say it's your airplane because it is your airplane.
Okay.
So he went with it.
Sure.
So they then hired a company to use a robotic submersible
mm-hmm.
to go and find this. However,
this wreckage was deeper than the Titanic. This is one of the deepest dives that had happened in the world to this point.
Yes, up to this point. This was going to be the deepest on record for a robotic submersible ever. So
the submersible is called Gemini.
Yes, it was called Gemini. It's actually pretty famous. But they, in order to get it down that deep, they had to build a whole new long cable.
There was not yet in existence a fiber optic cable long enough to reach the seafloor.
For one. And two, this was a tethered submersible. These days, we have a lot of untethered submersibles that don't need...
But this was the only way it could be controlled and right. to have the camera footage sent to the surface.
Right. Immediately. So, they had to build a very long cable, which took a very long time and a lot of money. How long? Well, a year. So, it took a year for them to get this cable done. And then eventually, they were able to attempt the dive. When they did get down there, they immediately found the airplane. Hmm. Without question, they found the landing gear and went, that's an airplane. That's from a 747. No question. They knew they found it. They recovered some pieces of the wreckage over that period of time, pulling up some, whatever they needed. And then they found the important thing, one of them. They found the CVR.
Turns out the underwater locator beacon wasn't working because the solder that holds the beacon together melted.
Ooh.
That's not a good sign.
No, it's not. It means that fire was hot.
Yes, it was.
Oh, there are many indications of how hot this fire was. But yep. CVR was like, I wish I could tell you I was here, but I can't, so I won't.
They did find relatively large chunks of debris, which means they probably hit without too high of a rate of speed. But they did determine that the airplane hit uncontrolled. We'll talk about that later on, but that's basically all I've got.
And it potentially skipped like a rock on the surface at one point?
Yeah.
I hate that sentence. Since I don't say it in my part, because I didn't know how much you were going to say, They managed to send the CVR to the NTSB and retrieve all the data from it.
Oh, wow.
Over a year later.
Yep.
That's pretty impressive.
It really was.
But only about a minute and 20 seconds was valuable. The last minute and 20 seconds.
We'll talk about that in a minute.
Well, we also know
some things.
We know some things.
This investigation was performed by a court of inquiry headed by South Africa, with representation from the US, the UK, Mauritius, Japan, and China. There were a lot of Japanese on board.
That's unfortunate.
There were a lot of Taiwanese on board.
Well, they were...
Leaving Taiwan.
Yes.
Initial analysis prior to the discovery of the main wreckage was based on the few floating pieces they had, as well as autopsies of the few bodies that were floating. Investigators analyzed the pieces to see if there was any evidence of explosive device, which would have been shown by chemical evidence as well as any high-velocity pitting, neither of which was present. Why might they have been bombed? Because no one really likes South Africa.
Yeah, the issues with the entire world. Yeah.
There's a lot of things going on there.
And South African Airways was basically run by the government.
They're a flag carrier, yeah?
Yes.
They were a flag carrier, and they were quite literally run by the government. They were a government entity, owned and operated.
So that's one way to paint a target on your tail.
Quite literally.
And that's why they were not able to fly over a lot of places. That obviously since changed, however.
Oh, yes. A lot has changed.
Yes, a lot has changed. South African Airways eventually became privatized, ran out of money, got funded by the government again, still privatized, still running out of money, still flying somehow.
Okay.
Anyways.
This was also supported by the lack of evidence of decompression, as well as how the flight crew was managing the situation while on the radio. If they had an explosive decompression from an explosive, there would have been a whole... They would have called Mayday.
Yeah.
If they could.
Well, if it wasn't an explosion, how bad was the fire?
Bad.
Well, there are a couple of indicators for this. Amidst the wreckage was a graphite tennis racket that had melted.
And it takes a lot to melt graphite.
Demonstrating fire temperatures in excess of 600 degrees Celsius.
Ooh.
That's very hot.
That's ooh.
Furthermore, there was a full or almost full fire extinguisher with melted cargo netting on the outside, indicating that someone had taken it to the back cargo area and was trying to put out the fire, but it was too hot to even get close.
No! No! Ah!
Turns out that was actually what they were supposed to do.
They didn't have a fire extinguisher inside the cargo compartment!
I have a whole spiel.
Why?
Cool your jets is literally the last thing I cover.
Why?
Because
I'm asking now.
The FAA had some to say about it, okay?
They better, because that's freaking horrible.
The autopsies were conducted on the 8 bodies, with 5 of them being identified as being from seats 30E, 37A, 37D, 40D, and 42A. It is worth noting that these passengers probably moved due to the fire, so any effect, like any indication between their seat location and their injuries probably isn't relevant.
Okay.
All of the bodies contained soot.
Yeah, I would think so, with the fire.
Analysis was performed to detect the levels of carboxyhemoglobin, that's something I haven't said in a while, which is present in the bloodstream after smoke inhalation.
Yep.
2 of the bodies were found to have died of carbon monoxide intoxication, and their saturation levels were 60.5% and 67.2%.
Oh, that's horrible.
That means they died before impact.
Yes. That means the fire was so bad and impacting the passenger cabin to the point where people were dying.
Even with the doors open.
That's why I said when the doors were open, there were some people who didn't care. Because they weren't around to care.
They were the dead.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, yes. And
how many were dead at that point? No idea.
We don't know if everybody was incapacitated when they hit. They could never determine if the crew was incapacitated.
They determined that everyone in the cabin was either unconscious or dead.
Yeah.
Based on the carboxyhemoglobin saturation in those 2 bodies.
Ooh. Okay.
The flight deck, unsure. Really everyone else, unconscious or dead.
Mm-hmm.
That's horrible.
Yes.
After recovering pieces of the main wreckage, it became evident that the fire originated from the front pallet on the right-hand side in the cargo cabin behind the passengers. They also found heat damage to the top skin above the cargo hold that indicated temperatures of over 300 degrees Celsius on the outside skin of the aircraft.
Oh my gosh, it got that far?
Which is impressive given how much convective cooling you would get from flying.
Yeah. Ooh. What was on? Do we know what was on that pallet?
We're going to talk about that.
Tell me what's on that pallet.
There was also ample heat damage to the stringers, frame, and control cables in that section of the aircraft. You see a problem yet? Nothing in that pallet was described as dangerous goods. Just computers. Aha.
Lithium batteries!
But you may wonder, did they have lithium batteries? Though we have not discussed it yet on the podcast, lithium batteries are known for being volatile.
Explosive. You should not be put in a cargo compressive environment.
And leading to cargo fires, which is why you are not allowed to check a bag with lithium batteries.
Fun fact, there was one time, where an entire pallet of lithium batteries exploded, and
we're gonna talk about that one soon.
I'm gonna talk about that in a couple sentences. So in the episode, they said they didn't know if they had lithium batteries. People in the comments section on YouTube were like, they probably weren't lithium, it was too early for lithium batteries. If anyone took the time to read the report, it said that the computers were fitted with either nickel cadmium batteries or lithium batteries.
They had to have had lithium batteries. That's the only thing that would get them to explode like that.
Well, at this time in, technology,
they were very early.
Most of them were probably nickel cadmium batteries.
Which still burn.
But do they burn as bad as lithium batteries?
Not necessarily.
No. But it would have been rather few lithium batteries because this was very early for lithium batteries. Lithium batteries were invented, I think we saw in 1978, but they weren't really being put into computers till 1991.
Right.
So these would have been early, but it did list lithium batteries. However, the true danger of lithium batteries wasn't discovered until decades later when cargo flights started having hull losses for some reason.
We'll talk about that.
One day.
That was a UPS flight.
And a FedEx flight.
Yep.
Several of each.
Yep.
Turns out.
One very prominent one, though.
Lithium's bad.
Yeah, why do you think they tell you that you can't put your laptops in your check living.
But
yeah.
Because that happened later, it doesn't surprise me that in this instance, they listed the cargo as safe and deemed the source of the fire as undetermined.
No. My guess would be is it could have been a low amount of lithium batteries. Who knows how many computers were on that pallet, right? But It literally could have been
one.
And then if that one exploded, it can cause a chain reaction.
Oh, guess what? A fire and explosions expert from Boeing discounted electrical arcing or smoking materials as being the cause and stated that it was definitely something in the cargo pallet and that whatever it was created a promoted fire, meaning it had an intrinsic supply of oxygen. The analysis then delved into the propagation of the fire, which was attributed to the packing materials in the cargo area, such as cardboard
yeah,
and plastic
yeah,
which would have generated a toxic gas that rose to the ceiling of the cargo compartment and then ignited and created a flash fire, as evidenced by the damage to the ceiling found in the wreckage. And it could have flashed over multiple times. As the fire kept going, more gases built up. Flash, flash, flash. Temperatures of such flash fires range upwards of 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit or 1,100 degrees Celsius.
Well, which is horrible. Bad.
So, you know, whenever you see in those firefighting TV shows, you know, the ones that I watch, and that you see a flashover and no one lives, that's why. It's hot.
Immediately super insanely hot.
But then they usually die down after using up all available oxygen. So why didn't it die down?
Because they opened the doors?
Well, not to the cargo area. They couldn't get back there.
Was it because it burned through the skin of the aircraft?
The answers actually answer quite a few questions, including how the smoke in the cabin got so bad. First off is the design of the combi. It was designed so that the pressure in the passenger cabin was greater than that of the cargo cabin, so that if the door between the two opened while there was a fire, the smoke wouldn't flood the cabin and the smoke wouldn't go into the cabin via the overhead vents. That totally makes sense.
Theoretically,
I am on
yes.
board.
But there is a physics problem.
This was verified during certification. The certification test required lighting a pile of tobacco leaves.
That's a weird
Of
all the things to test on, tobacco.
So they would take a pile of tobacco leaves in the cargo area, light it on fire, and then go into the passenger cabin and confirm that there's no smoke. Great, they did that. But this fire is way worse than a pile of tobacco leaves.
Way
Well, and
worse.
They had to open the windows to get... smoke out.
So. We're before that. There's a ton of smoke in the passenger cabin. Why? Well, per Boyle's Law that we all learned in high school chemistry, or should have, unless you failed high school chemistry.
Or don't remember it.
Yeah.
When temperature increases in a vessel, so does the pressure. So that whole thing about the pressure in the cargo area being less than the passenger cabin.
So very basic physics problem. You heat up that cargo cabin, and that suddenly becomes much higher pressure.
And now it's pressing... the smoke into the passenger cabin.
So when they open the door, instead it goes the other way.
And it was coming out the vents, and it...
Especially because they decided to put... Do you talk about that? Recirc?
I'm not there yet. It's in the next paragraph.
Never mind. That's why I asked. Never mind.
The second answer comes from a checklist that the crew likely performed called the Smoke Removal Checklist. I like the name. Maybe you should have read it.
Theoretically.
Which includes turning on the cabin recirculating... air to dissipate the fire.
Oh, well, that...
Or to dissipate the smoke.
Yeah, that kind of makes sense.
You can see why that's a bad idea, because you are now feeding oxygen to the fire and moving smoke throughout everywhere.
So the thought is good if the fire doesn't exist anymore.
Turns out the checklist is supposed to be used after the fire is extinguished.
And it wasn't.
Broski.
So what this did instead, because it was supposed to remove smoke... was instead it provided oxygen...
to the already bad fire.
To the fire.
And make the fire worse.
It also, because this recirc system was based at the top of the cabin, all the way from the cargo compartment to through the passenger compartment, meant that it pulled the smoke from the cargo compartment...
and put it in the passenger
cabin. Into the passenger cabin.
Did they know for sure that that's what happened?
Yes.
How?
That's a guarantee. Because of all of the signs they had from the wreckage about... smoke damage about...
In the vents,
everything.
So how did the crash itself happen? There are already a couple of indicators of this. Miranda has pointed out a couple.
Yeah, the control features of the aircraft, cables, and...
That's option number three. Let's...
burn through.
Cool our jets. Well, they couldn't.
Well, and electrical systems were offline, and then, yeah.
So, number one, the crew becoming incapacitated. This was deemed to be unlikely, as they had oxygen masks, and it sounded like they had used them on the radio. But it's not impossible that they either weren't or weren't the whole time of the emergency and eventually became incapacitated. That one, there's no way to ever know. I also don't know if they found the cockpit.
They didn't say that anywhere that I could find. I don't know whether they did or didn't.
There's also a setting on the oxygen mask to just have it feed normal air. I don't know why they would have turned it on. But they might have.
Or they might have inadvertently.
So it's unlikely, but it's a non-zero chance.
Right.
Number two, the aircraft broke up. It is possible, due to the state of the wreckage, that some of the airframe wasn't with the rest of the wreckage. But this was very difficult to tell on the seafloor after a year.
Yeah.
And you know, the ocean moves.
Yep.
It's not a static system. That would be right. Nice. Investigators determined that if the aircraft had broken up, though, it would have been at a very low altitude based on the spread of the wreckage found. There were two separate wreckage fields, 200 meters apart, but that's still pretty close together.
Yep.
Wrinkling in the skin of the aft fuselage and empennage is suggestive of a structural failure, but, you know, that also could have happened at impact.
Yes.
So, not really evidence one way or the other.
Right.
Three, what most likely to me personally was the case, and to Miranda, was that there was interference with the control cables due to fire.
Yeah.
Yep.
This would have led to a loss of control of the control surfaces in the tail, which, you know, control pitch.
And stuff.
It's a bad time. Stuff. Destruction of wire harnesses in that section also would have exacerbated their loss of control, as evidenced by the CVR picking up the sound of 80 circuit breakers popping.
Well, yeah, that's horrifying. They were popping like popcorn.
And the crew also reported to air traffic control losing electrics, you know, because every circuit breaker is popping. It said there's only 58 in the cockpit, so I don't know how they determined up to 80 popped.
Don't know.
Maybe they tried pushing them back in and they pop back out.
Could be.
I don't know.
Whatever the case, what's astonishing is that 80-second period of time. That, think about that.
81 seconds.
Yes, 81 seconds, but still, think about that for just a second. They get the alarm, and 81 seconds later, the fire was hot enough to burn through the cables for the CVR.
Okay, so they got the fire warning within 80 seconds of all the circuit breakers popping, but they got that warning late.
Which is true. That still doesn't mean it wasn't fast.
So let me go into the spiel, aka section 3 of the report, given by the FAA. They added some comments to the report, stating that although Class B cargo compartments have increased in size and cargo packages have increased, the certification of the Class B cargo compartments have remained virtually the same, and that compliance with existing criteria is not sufficient to prevent an uncontrolled cargo fire. So, the back half of the main cabin is not the same level of classification as the cargo compartment below deck. Below deck is called Class C cargo compartment. This right. one is a Class B,
yep.
and that's important. The certification criteria relied on a crew member being able to go back and fight the fire, unlike with Class C cargo, where it is not accessible by the crew and has more fire containment features installed accordingly. The requirement for fire detection and suppression were found to be inadequate.
No, really?
Yeah.
The smoke detector being on the ceiling didn't detect fire at floor level until there was enough heat to force that smoke that high. Suppression by a crew member can be hampered by the cargo itself, making it difficult to get to the fire, and this would have been further hampered if they were in an emergency descent.
Yeah.
You're having to climb the floor mm-hmm. to get to the fire. You don't even know where the fire is, and you are the only fire suppression technique. You, a person.
Yeah.
With a fire extinguisher, which they didn't discharge, at least the one they found,
yeah.
wasn't discharged.
There were multiple.
It was found to be in the cargo compartment, but not used.
Well, let's think about this logically, right? I mean, by the time that they realized that there was a problem and someone went back there to try to put it out, the fire was so hot.
Yep.
When you go in, you're toast.
Pretty much.
You may recall that there was cargo netting melted onto that fire extinguisher.
Right. So who knows what happened to that person who tried to extinguish that fire? I mean, I would hate to think what...
I bet that
how
they...
How hot that area
I bet
was.
They ran out mm-hmm. of the cargo compartment because that fire extinguisher was found.
Yep.
Meaning it was not burned to a crisp.
Who knows? We don't know. But
we don't know.
I would hate to know what would happen. What happened?
Well, one way or another, they died. So. The FAA met with a group of representatives from Boeing, McDonnell Douglas, Alaska Airlines, FedEx, and the Los Angeles Fire Department to review Class B cargo compartments, and they determined that the existing regulations, quote, do not provide an acceptable level of safety in terms of smoke and fire protection, end quote. They go on to further state that pallets should not be used to carry cargo in Class B compartments. It's unlikely that crew members would be able to extinguish a fire in flight, and any reliance on them to do so should be discontinued. The number of fire extinguishers provided for such a task is also inadequate. The review team issued a notice of proposed rulemaking that proposed an airworthiness directive to modify all Class B cargo compartments to either be reconfigured as Class C compartments or require the use of flame penetration resistant cargo containers. In response, they received comments from airlines that there wasn't enough evidence that Class B compartments were unsafe.
This wasn't enough?
No, apparently.
I feel like this should be enough.
And that it would be very expensive to turn Class B compartments into Class C, and that would jeopardize the usefulness of combi aircraft. They thought that increased fire detection, suppression, and extinguishment features should solve the problem.
No.
Conversely, pilot associations urged a complete ban on Class B cargo compartments. Because they're like, you want me to go back there? Nah.
I'm chill, bro. I'm good.
It turns out this is the option they went with. Sort of.
No. Okay, so a while later, ultimately, the FAA did issue an airworthiness directive in August of 1989, requiring operational and equipment changes and design modifications to maximize fire detection and control. I'm going to read this entire paragraph, and you are going to decide what you think the airlines did. These included updating the smoke and fire detection systems and providing an oral and visual warning to the station assigned to individuals trained to fight cargo fires, requiring a fire extinguishing system in the compartment to suppress the fire until a crew member can finish it off, training individuals to fight cargo fires, providing fire-resistant cargo compartment liners, providing two-way communication into the cargo compartment, providing increased lighting in the cargo compartment, requiring loading to allow access to all cargo by a firefighting crew member, and providing a cargo compartment temperature indication system to the flight deck and the designated firefighting station in the cabin. Also required were additional portable fire extinguishers, protective garments, breathing apparatuses, and thermal protective covers for black boxes, windows, safety devices, wiring, flight controls, and other vital equipment in the cargo cabin. Or you could just convert them to Class C compartments.
They just did Class C. Or they got rid of the aircraft altogether.
Guess what they actually did? They got rid of them.
That would be the cheapest thing to do.
This was pretty much the last time that a combi aircraft was flown with a Class B compartment.
Basically, what the FAA did with this AD, because they knew the airlines were fighting them on this, is they were like, okay, if you want to keep flying these, you have to do all this.
Or...
With the goal of them wanting the airlines to just change them to Class C compartments.
I mean, period. That's the best way to do it.
And they couldn't say that in the AD, so they just wrote a litany of that the airlines needed to do to sway them the other way.
So...
Basically, make it as expensive as possible to keep Class B cargo compartments.
Right. That does not mean, like I said at the beginning of this episode, that combi aircraft don't exist today. However, they have very different requirements now, and they're generally just Class C compartments. On purpose. As a matter of fact, by the time that this aircraft was finally retired from service because of this accident, which it had actually been around for 20-some-odd years, means that it was a pretty successful combi, actually. The fact that they hadn't had a major accident up to that point with a combi said something. But at the same time, they didn't want it to happen again because they did find this deficiency. It was basically a matter of time. But Boeing hadn't created the 747-400 combi yet. They would do that in the 90s. KLM would be the operator of such a thing, the primary operator of such a thing, although there were others, but KLM was the primary one. And they operated them. They were planning to operate them until 2021, and then COVID happened. So they stopped operating them in 2020. And that was the last time that a 747 combi operated. And probably ever will operate again. But they operated them successfully for also about 20 some odd years, which is good. They were pretty successful combi aircraft, but those had Class C compartments on the 400 variant. And then there are still 737 combis out there. There's other combi type aircraft in the world that also exist.
We also found out, though, that like things like lithium batteries can't be put in cargo holds.
Yeah, it turns out.
Yeah.
Because I honestly,
they explode.
I think it dumbfounds me that Mayday didn't bring that up. It says it in the report that there was lithium in the cargo compartment.
Yeah.
Well, and to be fair, they did not realize how bad.
No,
the report they didn't say how bad because they didn't know, but Mayday knew. Mayday made this not as long ago as this accident.
Right. Still, whatever the case, this was a precursor to that.
So my point is I just want you all to know that, yes, there was lithium in the cargo compartment. Don't speculate on it. It was stated in the report.
And that said, that doesn't mean that lithium is completely banned from all cargo compartments, but there are very specific ways that it has to be handled, carried, and compartments it can go in.
You remember how I said those fire penetration resistant cargo containers?
Yeah, those.
Yeah, those.
Because that way, if something explodes and catches on fire, it doesn't get everywhere else.
Right.
It just stays contained and then is eventually put out by itself.
Yeah.
And those cargo container.
And cargo containers like that also have their own fire extinguishing systems.
Right.
So for those of you who don't know, when baggage handlers are stacking stuff in the plane, there's they can't just stack it to the top. They have to leave a clearance, and that clearance is required for the fire suppression system.
Yep.
Yeah, that way if, you know, there's a fire, they can put it out.
Yep. Yeah. So those are built in.
Yeah.
And lithium is also stored properly.
Yes, correct.
Now that we know.
So let's take a break, then we'll do the normal things, and then we'll talk about the external factors to this, kind of.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Okay, we're back. We do get to do all the normal things, kind of. The probable cause isn't called a probable cause, but...
It's a board of inquiry. I'm not surprised. Yeah.
The sections, though, are still pretty much the same.
Well, it was in compliance with the ICAO.
It was.
The only section that was out of the ordinary was that FAA review, which I'm glad they did.
Yes. There is an NTSB recommendation section, which is separate. We'll talk about that at the very end. They only made three, but we'll talk about that at the end. But there are findings, and I'm doing some of them. Again, the pertinent ones. They found that at the time of the takeoff from Chiang Kai-shek Airport, Taipei, in Taipei, Taiwan, the aircraft was serviceable with no reported carried forward defects. In other words, any defect still rolling.
Nothing was wrong with the aircraft as of that point.
It was correctly loaded and carried sufficient fuel, so they couldn't determine that any of that had anything to do with anything at all. They found that the aircraft was configured as a 7-pallet combi with 6 pallets in place for the flight. So they could hold 7 pallets, but there were 6 of them on board. They found that the flight proceeded normally until some 9 hours after the aircraft had left Chiang Kai-shek Airport in Taipei, when an intense fire developed in the right-hand forward pallet. They found that the substances involved in the combustion included plastic and cardboard packing materials, but the actual source of ignition cannot be determined.
We have a strong idea.
Suspicion. And we'll, speculation, technically.
It is a speculation which led to conspiracy.
Okay, my speculation is not a conspiracy. My speculation is batteries, but...
Yes, we're taking this from what it is.
There are a lot of conspiracy theories regarding this crash. I almost today considered not covering it at all because we said we would not cover things regarding conspiracies. So we're not going to really talk a whole lot about them, right. But consider the fact that South Africa was a target. They had an embargo on arms, and they were actively at war with Angola.
And then there were some scientists that got involved and managed to get some of the materials from the aircraft that they then believed to show signs that there was an explosive on board, for one. And two, there was also the belief that perhaps nuclear materials were involved.
Come on.
Well, the belief behind this, so to explain why this is also a theory, is because, and this is not a theory they put in the report, but this is a theory that a lot of people have.
On Wikipedia.
Yes. Is because it was very difficult for South Africa to get materials and they were at war with another country.
They had an arms embargo. No one would sell them arms.
Nobody. So there's a lot of people that figured that South Africa Airways, being government owned, and operated, was smuggling things into the country.
And not putting it on the manifest.
So there was theories that there was things in the cargo hold that weren't on the manifest, that they were carrying
whatever.
Arms. We don't know. We don't know.
No, but come on.
And the biggest factor that ultimately makes that pretty much a no is, one, the airplane flew for quite some time. Before the fire was reported, one. Two, the crew was reporting to air traffic control for quite some time and seemed to have control of their aircraft.
Yeah, and if they were smuggling things, my guess would be, why would they do that?
Right.
Also, there would have been explosive residue.
Right.
Which they didn't find.
And regardless, there was a fire which persisted very quickly, which means that it was fed by the materials we know were in the compartment.
Which turns out was boxes.
Yes. And packing materials, specifically, basically, the packing foams and plastics.
Like polystyrene.
Right.
AKA styrofoam.
Styrofoam.
Yup.
And what do computers usually come in?
Styrofoam.
Styrofoam.
So to that end, and the reason that
By the way, don't burn styrofoam.
No, it's not a good idea. It's very toxic for you.
Please don't.
Just don't do it.
Also, if you're going to recycle it, please check with your local recycling companies first.
That they're not an incinerating one? Because it's bad.
Not they're not an incinerating one, but also that they take styrofoam, because not all of them do.
Most of them don't, actually.
Ours doesn't.
Yeah, it's really frustrating, actually, when you want to get rid of it, because you either have to go throw it away, which is terrible for the environment. Really horrible, actually.
Or find one of the few recycling companies that does take it on, like, the other end of your state.
And you have to pay a lot of money to do it. It's really frustrating.
Especially when you buy a lot of TVs in, like, 3 years.
Yeah. Or they should find a different way of packing things.
So agreed!
It's not with styrofoam.
Agreed! It is a hard thing to do, though.
Patent pending?
Anyways, I bring all that up because the next point is also very relevant to that. So they wanted to point these things out. Be it that there's no sign, there's no idea where the fire actually ignited from, because the next one is, they found that it is virtually certain that there was no sabotage, there was no explosion in the aircraft, and the presence of a pressure or time-activated incendiary device was extremely unlikely. There was theories that there were certain volatile compounds that could have ignited on their own due to vibration. They found that the fire generated considerable smoke, carbon monoxide, and carbon dioxide, which penetrated to the passenger cabin and possibly to the cockpit. They found that the fire caused extensive heat damage to the fuselage structure, the insulation blankets, and electric wiring in the main cargo deck area, including the wire serving the power supply to the cockpit voice recorder, which happened fast. They found that at the time of the accident, the aircraft, a Boeing 747-244B Combi, complied with the certification requirements of a Class B main deck cargo compartment.
And the FAA themselves said, maybe our certifications suck.
Right. Save that adequate flight tests do not appear to have been conducted in terms of FAR 25.855E2 to show compliance with the requirements of FAR 25.857B2 for Class B cargo compartments concerning the entry of hazardous quantities of smoke into compartments occupied by passengers.
This was the time I agreed with the FAA.
Yeah.
When the FAA did their job, right? It happens.
Occasionally.
In the light of further experience since... That's what it says. In the light of further experience, since these requirements were formulated, they can no longer be regarded as adequate from a safety point of view. The FAA has pointed out that the configuration was shown during flight tests to exclude hazardous quantities of smoke from the occupied compartments using criteria for testing which had been developed from years of transport experience. End quote. In the board's view, however, the effects of thermal expansion were not adequately demonstrated in the tests.
Thermal expansion is that whole Boyle's Law thing of hot equals lots of pressure.
Yep.
Science.
Science.
You know what's surprising to me?
The fact that I remembered it was called Boyle's Law?
No.
Also, yes.
That doesn't surprise me. You're autistic and have ADHD.
I was
You're also
surprised.
Just very smart, but...
Yes. That just means Christy remembers a lot of stuff that other people don't remember.
Yes, but...
But what surprises me is that they were like, the worst fire that could ever happen is the same amount of fire that happens when we burn a bunch of tobacco.
Yeah, no.
I really don't know where that came from. That also wasn't in the report. That is from the Mayday episode, which we've already shown is super factual. But I can't help but think that they wouldn't have put that in there if there wasn't some shred of truth to that one.
I mean, sure. But still, there feels like... It's also just a terrible way to test things.
Yeah.
Also, tobacco?
Right. It's not good for your health.
No matter
how you do that test, not going to be a very...
I mean, given the age that the 747 was certified...
Yeah, I know.
Everyone testing, it was probably a bunch of smokers anyway.
Because they didn't realize that it was bad for you yet.
Probably. So they probably got quite the high, or whatever you describe nicotine as.
Just an addiction?
Yeah.
I wouldn't say it gives you a high.
A hit? I don't know. I don't smoke. Can you tell?
Whatever the case. Anyways, we found that the fire/smoke detection systems in the Boeing 747-244B Combi main deck cargo compartment were inadequate. Although the evidence indicates that the fire/smoke detection system functioned, the extent to which the fire developed and the fact that smoke penetrated the passenger cabin suggested that the fire was not discovered early enough to prevent these consequences.
Nope.
That is correct. They found that the firefighting facilities provided for the main deck cargo compartment were inadequate.
Yes.
Fire extinguisher.
The word inadequate is happening a lot.
A handheld fire extinguisher. Yes, they really like that word for a good reason. They found that the aircraft was not under control when it crashed into the sea.
Nope.
To elaborate on that, they found that the only possible causes for the loss of control were one or more of the following. A, pilot incapacity from carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide poisoning.
Maybe, but probably not.
And or smoke inhalation or disorientation consequent on reduced cockpit visibility in smoke or pilot distraction. They may have flown it into the ground. It was dark and they were over water. They couldn't see anything.
I mean, that's very similar to the UPS flight.
They also had nothing working in the cockpits.
So. I would say that's more likely than the carbon monoxide poisoning.
I agree.
True. I would agree with that as well.
They had nothing working in the cockpit. More than likely, they were losing controls. They were losing all of their senses, basically. They couldn't see. So more than likely, it might have been CFIT. Or in this case, controlled flight into water.
I would say it's a possibility, but unlikely given all of the other situations.
Sure. Or B, damage to the structure and or to the control systems of the aircraft directly or indirectly caused by the fire.
Yeah, that one. I like that one.
I'm not an expert, but
I like that one.
But I like they said, like they said at the beginning of this, it could have been one or more of the following. So it could have been both.
All of them?
Yeah.
Although, like I said, I don't think that the flight crew was incapacitated, but we don't know.
We don't know.
It's a non-zero chance.
Yeah. They found that irrespective of which of these causes might have been operative in the crash itself, there is a strong possibility that the quantity of the carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide released by the fire caused loss of consciousness in or the death of some, if not all, of the occupants before the aircraft crashed into the sea.
So most, if not all, people were already dead or incapacitated by the time they hit the water.
For better or worse, that is the case.
Does that make it better or worse?
Don't know.
Would you rather suffocate?
Yeah, I mean, carbon monoxide, like dying from smoke inhalation, is pretty horrible. Brutal.
It was super toxic fumes, too.
It's suffocation. So it's pretty brutal.
You're suffocating and you're also like choking because the fumes that you're inhaling are also toxic.
Now, you may think that I asked that question to just dwell on the morbidity of it, but one of the facts within aviation is when things like this happen, someone's getting sued. And whoever's getting sued, one of the factors is the experience of the victims.
Mm-hmm.
You are going to...
How bad was it?
As a plaintiff, you are going to get more money if whoever you are suing on behalf of suffered more. So asking the question of, is it better to suffocate from toxic fumes or is it better to slam into the ocean is a valid question.
Probably the slam into the ocean would be.
Well, it depends on how hard and how, you know.
It's morbid.
Did they break up on impact? That's the big thing, which it did. So... all these things to say that's, I don't know.
Yeah, it's so suffocation it's or blunt force trauma.
Right.
Blunt force trauma is faster.
Generally, yes.
But we don't know how hard they hit anyway.
Yeah. They found that despite intensive investigation, the board was unable to find or conclude that fireworks or any other illegal cargo were carried in the aircraft.
It would be really funny if it was fireworks.
Would it?
So there was a theory about...
small, tiny explosions of light.
The... theory about that.
I would find it entertaining.
Yes.
Probably not if I was on the plane. To be fair.
What they intend by like fireworks is like sparklers, because they pointed this out in the episode actually, but there was this theory that existed because there were marks on some of the wreckage from around the compartment.
Of like iron.
Well,
like
and
sparks.
It's, right. Like it's the little burn marks. That would be caused by...
sparklers.
Sparks from things like sparklers.
I don't know if sparklers would be able to produce such a high... like,
part of why they... part of why they suggested that is because they were assuming that it looked like something that had its own oxygen source that could make burn marks like that.
Which, my section of the analysis never delved into theories of what the oxygen source would have been in that instance.
Right.
I wonder how nickel cadmium burns or any other components of lithium. A computer.
Lithium tends to
spark.
Yes, and spark.
Then maybe it was the lithium.
That's my thought.
That would make the most sense.
I mean, the whole thing with the phones exploding in people's pockets was bad because they quite literally just go pop and spark. Like the big, giant, very hot thing very quick.
So yeah, maybe that's more proof that lithium was a source.
Yeah. Anyways, that's it for the findings.
Causal factors and responsibility. Okay, so listen. Oh, they go into the spiel.
Yeah, they do. They really do.
I was going to say, why are you saying responsibility? They're saying not responsibility.
Right.
The accident followed an uncontrolled fire in the forward right pallet on the main deck cargo compartment. The aircraft crashed into the sea at high speed following a loss of control consequent on the fire. English. Here is the section that is actually included with every report we ever read. We just never continually read it because it's the same thing every time.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of Section 12.1 of the Aviation Act No. 74 of 1962, as amended, the board is required to determine not only the cause of, but also responsibility for the accident. Compare paragraph 3.1 of Annex 13. There is, however, no basis in the evidence from which the board would be justified in assigning responsibility for the accident to any person or body, and therefore the board is unable to do so. So, at the root of every one of these aviation accident investigations is the fact that a cause needs to be found, and ultimately some form of responsibility for, not for any terms of litigation, not for suing, not for any of that, but to prevent it from happening again. Because whoever's responsibility it is whose responsibility it is to fix it going forward.
Right.
On that note, lawsuits cannot use these, to the best of my knowledge, as a not legal expert, cannot use these reports as evidence for lawsuits. And that's why they put that thing in every report. Because it's not to assign legal liability blame.
Right.
We've talked about that before.
We haven't talked about it in a long while.
No.
And they put it in their cause section, so it's worth hashing out.
Right. So now we're going to get into the recommendations. And this is going to be really short from my end, because they actually had a handful. However, they aren't worth reading because primarily all they're saying in almost all of these is we agree with the FAA about how to deal with combi-type aircraft and compartments shared with, passengers, occupants. So they're talking about all of this fire suppression systems and the requirements for the types of hazardous goods that can be put in there. And also just the changing it to a Class C compartment. So all of that to say, I'm not going to read almost any of their recommendations, but one, which does touch on the CVR and the FDR. For the CVR and the FDR, they recommend that, A, they should be fire protected in the aircraft, as should the wiring to the units.
Check.
Right. B, should where practicable have a backup system of battery power in the event of failure of the primary power source.
Check.
And C, should be fitted with a pinger system in which a first pinger operates for 30 days and a second 30-day pinger only commences operating after the first pinger ceases to function.
Sort of check.
Not really. So this is something we've changed.
There are some black boxes coming out that the underwater locator beacon has the potential to run for more than 30 days.
Yes. That's not to say it has a second one.
No. That's why I say sort of check.
That's adding a whole other system that honestly wouldn't be reliable enough to work.
If anything, technology has developed such that we can prolong the usefulness of the underwater locator beacon.
Correct.
It also does not now, it's an emergency locator beacon, not just underwater. So you don't have to pee on it to activate it if you crash on land.
Right.
Oh, I forgot we talked about that.
Yeah, we did.
Crashes.
We did.
Yeah.
So I thought it would be interesting to talk about this because we haven't talked about like CVRs and how they've changed over time and FDRs and how they've changed over time. But everything, of course, being digital now really is very helpful. So helpful.
Especially
so many things have changed
in a lot of ways since we started the podcast.
Oh, yeah.
I know it's been a hot minute, but now it's way more universal for CVRs to record for 2 hours instead of just half an hour.
And beyond that, most actually of the brand new aircraft, 787s, 350s, MAXs, NEOs, all of that, have very long record times for other parameters. We're talking 40 plus hours of data, which turns out to be extremely useful, like in the MAXs with the Lion Air one. So they did want to put a note, though, which I thought was interesting to this little...
An asterisk?
Yes. Note, quite literally it says, the suggestion that on long transocean flights, the CVR and DFDR should be
flight data recorder.
Yes, should be floatable. Overlooks the fact that in a short time, the recorders may drift away over long distances from the site of the aircraft wreckage.
Yeah, that's why they don't float.
That's why they don't float.
Well, and on top of that,
they have to survive an impact.
Yeah, the reason why they're so heavy is because the recorders are put in a box surrounded by metal,
crash resistant material,
so that they don't get damaged, so when they are found, they can be used.
Right. It's an unbelievably difficult thing to engineer that has been engineered very precisely. And unfortunately, there's absolutely no practicable way that it could float. There is no way you can do that and survive an accident.
I also don't want it to float, because it will float away.
Yeah, exactly. The pinger theory, though, if the pinger would work and it was floating, could make it easy to
find. Yeah, but we still
want
to find the wreckage.
But yes, correct. So, that's still not a thing. I will read this other recommendation, which is interesting, and then we'll go to the NTSB section. They recommend that the Boeing 747 emergency checklist for, quote, upper and main deck smoke evacuation, mixed passengers and cargo, end quote, and for, quote, main deck cargo fire / smoke, mixed passengers and cargo, end quote, respectively require to be integrated. No provision appears to be made for the situation in which there is an uncontrolled fire in the main deck cargo hold and a smoke problem in the passenger cabin and or cockpit. The matter to be cleared up is whether the crew should follow the smoke evacuation checklist if the fire is still burning. That last sentence is the most key thing there. I'll read it again. The matter to be cleared up is whether the crew should follow the smoke evacuation checklist if the fire is still burning.
Please don't.
Please don't.
That's a bad idea.
Big giant red text at the top of that checklist should read, do not use checklist if fire is still burning.
Because you're just going to give it oxygen and force the smoke into the cabin.
Right.
Please don't.
Especially when the aircraft was designed this way. Now, when you get to newer combi type aircraft where there's a different type of system designs and a different type of certification.
With Class C cargo compartments.
Then it's a little different story. But I digress. Their point remains valid that there needs to be clarification that when a fire is still burning, certain checklists cannot be used, especially when it comes to evacuation or how to handle the smoke.
Yeah.
Because unfortunately, not the right thing. The right thing they did determine, I mean, if they had gone down to the low altitude, opened the doors, and not turned on the recirc system, it actually may have saved lives. It would not probably have saved the aircraft, though, because the fire was caught too late.
It also wouldn't have saved everyone.
Nope.
Because some people were already...
No. Well, and ultimately the impact was probably too much anyways. So, all kind of a moot point in the end. But when it came to handling the smoke, it would have been perhaps better.
Well, didn't it say in that checklist that you shouldn't do it if the fire is still going?
No, that's what they're asking for clarification on.
Yes, not distinctly. It did not. It is a note that the NTSB's recommendations are only to the FAA because it's the only direct body that they could address, per se, here, that would basically be forced to respond, as well as also they're making it to the FAA for safety reasons in the U.S., of course, specifically because that's where their oversight is and that's what they care about.
But also, I think these recommendations were made because the NTSB was part of that review.
Yes.
With the FAA.
Correct.
So they just needed the legal jargon to say, we recommend you do this, even though you're the ones that said we should do this.
Right. So on May 16th, 1988, they issued three recommendations, and I will read all of them. They recommended requiring that all cargo carried in Class B cargo compartments of the United States registered aircraft be carried in fire-resistant containers until fire detection and suppression methods for Class B cargo compartment fires are further evaluated and revised as necessary. They also recommended conducting research to establish the fire detection and suppression methods necessary to protect transport aircraft from catastrophic fires in Class B cargo compartments, so the lower classifications. And they also recommended establishing fire-resistant requirements for the ceiling and sidewall liners in Class B cargo compartments that equal or exceed the requirements of Class C and Class D cargo compartments, as set forth in the applicable FARs. So, those are really, really, really hit home recommendations, if you ask me. They basically said, like, everything's got to be in a fire-resistant container until you fix the problem. You're going to fix the problem, or you're going to change it completely.
Yeah.
That was the whole gist of the three recommendations. That was it. So, and the research part is what's interesting to me. The third one was interesting because they were talking about, oh, we need to figure out what the right firefighting methods are and how to establish and prevent fires from breaching ceilings and walls in these compartments. However, we then had lithium fires.
Yeah.
Which we'll get to talk about in another episode. But that's all I've got.
Okay.
So this was a conspiracy theory one, but this one had a lot of wild aspects to it. Weird, crazy don't know.
Like, never thought we'd talk about it?
Nope.
Okay. Well, that was South African Airways flight
295.
Oh, I knew it had a 2 and a 5 in it.
Yep.
295. Thank you so much for listening and requesting this episode. If you would like to request an episode or recommend an episode, you may do so emailing us. Just realize that I'm not going to answer you right away.
Yep.
She did get through the list, though.
I did. So everything's up to date as of when we're recording this.
Yes.
So be aware, though, when you send us a... And I've said this numerous times before, but in case you're new here, and this is your first episode, and you would like to request an episode.
And for people who aren't new here, because some of y'all...
You need to find a report. Now, if you look on the Wikipedia page, and it you can clearly see at the bottom, because that's where we usually get ours from,
yeah.
Is the Wikipedia page or the ASN page.
Right. I would say if you don't see it directly on the Wikipedia page, or if you're having a hard time determining which one of those links in the references section is the report, if you see something that says accident description on Aviation Safety Network,
go to that,
go to the bottom of the page. There's a very clear PDF link if the report exists.
Right. Now, if you cannot find a report, that means I cannot find a report, right. Which means we cannot do that episode.
Now, to be fair, in this case, actually, in this episode, we tried on multiple occasions using
it. Says on the Wikipedia page.
It does say there's
people
a report
were
there.
Correct in recommending this.
Yes. And here's the thing, actually. We did have to go digging for this one because
the link is broken.
Yeah, the link was broken on both the Wikipedia page and the ASN.
But even the though FAA...
it shows that it's there, but then we Googled the report and the FAA just had it.
So,
because
it was on their website.
If you want to go look up this report, hopefully Miranda linked the right thing. But in the event that she didn't, that's how
it's
you
find it.
A good
thing you said that, because I just usually copy it from our thing.
Yeah, no, it's
you have to look up Flight 295 final report.
Yes,
I would have preferred
SAA 295
updated
final
it on
report.
The thing so I could find it. But
well, it just has the Wikipedia page on the thing.
Anyway, so. Make sure that there's a report, please, because yes. We really can't do much. Like, someone who's new, I will say they're new, requested Lanza 508 again. And yeah. I was like, I'm sorry.
Our most requested ever.
But we won't do it because there's not enough factual information.
Unless one of y'all really decides to go to Peru and get the report.
Be our guest. I would love to do so myself, but it's just not in the cards right now.
We don't do it based off of...
hearsay.
Yeah. We do everything based off factual finding, usually from a report.
Yep.
Because then they've investigated what happened. And even though we kind of sort of know what happened, we don't like speculation. So
right.
please make sure there's a report before you email us and say, hey, also, please realize there's a lot of stuff coming up. We're almost 2 years out. So your recommendation might already be on our list.
Yes.
But I would also say if you're new, check and make sure it's not already done.
Yeah.
That hasn't happened in a while, but it has happened before where someone's like, oh, yeah, you already covered that. I was like, yeah.
Yes, we
yeah,
did.
Someone was like, can you cover SV, I think it was 163? I'm like,
we did that.
I started reading on Wikipedia. I'm like, this sounds familiar.
Yes, it is.
And we all looked at each other and were like, did we do this?
Yes.
And to be fair, sometimes I'm dumb. And we put an extra thing in there now, so we don't do that.
There is now a feature on our spreadsheet, because I am a spreadsheet nut.
That way, if it's not written in the same way someone else wrote it in,
the date
will pop up. And sometime, we've had one instance where there's two dates that are the same, but they're different crashes.
Yes, one.
One instance. But otherwise, we have not had that happen. Also realize if I covered it in a Miranda-sode, we're not covering it as a main episode because right. We already covered it.
Right.
So.
Sorry.
Sorry. But that's true.
But if you want to hear them, which they are great, go to Patreon.
And here's our Patreon plug where you should yes. Go to the Patreon and give us your money.
Yes.
Or become a free patron because now that's a thing.
Yes.
Unfortunately, you don't get anything for being a free patron other than showing that you support us.
Yes, which, thank you.
Is appreciated. Thank you very much. If you would like discounts on merch, ad-free episodes, merch that we send you, blooper reels, post-episodes, all that stuff.
We give you all sorts of things.
Check out the Patreon. There are, like, 5-minute versions of everything on Patreon, like little sneak peeks.
Yeah, yeah.
That if you would like to, I don't know, start listening to a post episode or a blooper reel, whatever, you can do that as a free patron, and then you can decide later if you would like to join or not. We will leave that up to you. Either way, we appreciate you listening, so.
you know.
Yeah, and all that to say, we appreciate it if you can, we appreciate it if you can't, but do all the things, subscribe, keep liking things, keep sharing it with everybody. That helps us the most.
Yes.
By far and away.
Because then more people come and they listen, and right. That's great.
If you have been thinking about joining Patreon, but maybe there's something that would entice you to do it more, you have an idea for something we could add to it, if it's logistically possible, let us know and we'll try. Oh my
God, please tell us.
We don't know.
We haven't changed much about her Patreon in quite some time because we don't know. We try to think up ideas and we've had some over time, but at the same time, there's not a lot that's like really calling our name. So if there's something out there that seems like it's logistically possible and we haven't thought of it, please suggest it, especially if it's something that might entice you to join.
Yes.
And it's free for us to do. We cannot go on tour. We're too poor.
Yeah, there's not.
I don't know if this show would work very well on tour.
No. But if there are things that you think would be valuable, give it to us. If it's very low cost, too, that is possible. But
the podcast doesn't make that much money.
It really doesn't. It's pretty much entirely self-sufficient, but that's about it.
Yeah.
It's not a profitable organization in pretty much any sense of the word at this point in time.
So please realize that we can't do like big things.
No.
But we will try to do small things.
Yes.
If you could think of small things.
Yes.
We can do small things.
Right.
All right. After that big ramble bamble, thank you so much for listening. We do appreciate it. We hope you have a safe and healthy week, and we'll catch you all next week.
Keep your speed up.
Please like and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Hard Landings Podcast and on Twitter at Hard Landings Pod.
Subscribe and leave a 5-star review on the platform you are using to listen.
If you would like to see photos and sources for this episode, please visit us at hardlandingspodcast.com, where you can also leave us feedback and ask questions.
This episode was researched and written by Nick and Christy and edited by the lovely Paige.
Our theme song was written by Miranda and performed by all three of us plus Leo.
And our logo is by Naomi.
Thanks for listening. Catch you next time.